This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Barack Obama wins 10 in a row. John McCain has a virtual lock on the Republican nomination. Texas and Ohio become crucial states for Hillary Clinton. And a powerful union is expected to endorse Obama in a few hours. A bit later, the power of Obama's rhetorical skill. Does a great speaker make a great leader? It's Wednesday, and time for another edition of The Political Junkie.
There you go again.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin joins us for the latest on the presidential race and other political news. Senator Obama's momentum continues with wins last night in Wisconsin and Hawaii. Senator McCain defeats Governor Mike Huckabee in both GOP races. Senator Clinton looks to Texas and Ohio to save her campaign, and Senator Obama's inspiring oratory. Both his opponents are taking swipes at him. How powerful are words? And last but not least, Ken's got a luau of a trivia question for us. Later, some heavenly happenings. But first, if you have questions about yesterday's results or what's next in the presidential race, give us a call. In a few minutes, we'll focus on Senator Obama's inspirational speeches. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. NPR political editor Ken Rudin is with me now in Studio 3A. Good to have you, Ken.
Hi, Lynn.
Now, we have to go to that trivia question first, and I understand it's got a Hawaiian theme.
Well, yes. Yesterday was the Hawaii caucuses, which Barack Obama won with like 73% of the vote, which is pretty remarkable. He was born in Hawaii, as you know. Who was the last person born in Hawaii who ran for president?
Okay. Who was the last person born in Hawaii who ran for president?
No, I just asked you that.
And if you know the answer to that question that we both just asked you, or if you even think you know the answer, give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send an email to talk@npr.org. I have absolutely no idea. All right, Ken, let's start with the news that has just come out today that the powerful Teamsters Union is expected to endorse Barack Obama.
Well, he is on a roll. Last Friday, Barack Obama got the endorsement of the Service Employees Union, the SEIU, which is 1.9 million members. Today, the report is that he's going to meet with James Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters Union, which has 1.4 million members. And while Hillary Clinton does have more unions backing her, it's another sign that momentum, and that's such a key word in this battle for the Democratic nomination, the momentum is going Barack Obama's way.
That's got to be a big blow for Hillary Clinton, I would think, the Teamsters. I mean, she's been courting the unions, and working class people are supposed to be part of her base.
Well, you know, if you go back to what we started saying months and months ago, this was Hillary Clinton's nomination to lose. We used the word inevitable over and over again. Even the Clinton campaign thought that this would be over by February 5th. Super Tuesday. And since February 5th, Barack Obama has won 10 contests in a row, including yesterday in Wisconsin and Hawaii. Now, I don't think all of these last 10 contests have been surprising. I think a lot of people thought Obama would win, but the margins he's winning by is remarkable. And especially we saw in Wisconsin that he started picking at Hillary Clinton's coalition, which had been women. Now, Hillary Clinton did win women, but not by much, and blue-collar whites, and Barack Obama won that in Wisconsin. And again, that had been part of Hillary Clinton's coalition.
And she's banking on those kinds of voters, I think, as we move into Ohio in particular, right?
Well, she's got to. I mean, Ohio and Texas are the big prizes on March 4th, well, less than 2 weeks away. It reminds some people of Rudy Giuliani having basically spent everything, bet the farm on Florida and didn't get that far. It's not really an apt analogy because Hillary Clinton has been running in every state, but she's got to win somewhere. At some point, she's going to have to reclaim the mantle of the inevitable front runner. And with Barack Obama having at least like a delegate lead of 150 delegates right now, you need 2,025 to clinch the nomination. But she's got to show the Democrats that she's capable of winning 10 in a row is pretty remarkable. I think if you look back in presidential history, or at least since the primaries became important, no ultimate nominee has ever lost 10 contests, primaries, and caucuses in a row and gone on to win the nomination.
But still, that delicate lead that you mentioned, pretty close.
It is close. It's absolutely close, because Hillary Clinton, one, still has the lead among superdelegates. Those are the 796 party elected officials who can endorse a candidate regardless of how they're doing in their own state. And again, Hillary Clinton did have a very good Super Tuesday, winning California, handling New York, New Jersey, states like that. But since then, it's been all Barack Obama, and if she's going to turn the tide, she's got to do it on March 4th. A lot of people in both camps say that if she could not win Ohio or Texas or both on March 4th, that could be the end of her campaign.
We're talking with our very own political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Darren, and Darren is calling from Idaho, I believe. Hi, Darren.
Hi, I just have two quick comments. Do you think that Hillary's painted herself into a corner with her minimizing all the contests? We don't do well in caucuses, we don't do in small states, to where she's painted herself into this Ohio and Texas corner. And the other is, do you anticipate a backlash with her talk that Obama's talk is cheap? Therefore, the premise is, if you like Obama, you're kind of been fooled by just good rhetoric.
Well, as far as the second part, we're going to talk about that later in the show, about rhetoric, and that's a very, very good point. The Clinton people feel that a lot of what he's saying is just talk, is just rhetoric, and there's no substance behind that, and we'll talk about that. But as far as the first part, I think what you're raising a very important point, that Hillary Clinton may not have had a plan B, that ultimately it was always going to be she was going to win Iowa, she was also going to win New Hampshire, and just like Al Gore did in 2000 and John Kerry did in 2004, the race would soon be over. And if that were not the case, she had 20-point leads in most of the Super Tuesday states. Now, she did win a lot of them, but Barack Obama won a majority of the states at stake on February 5th. And it's almost like she didn't plan for Barack Obama to, one, be outraising her. He raised $36 million in January. We always thought it was $32 million, which was still remarkable. It's now 36. She raised $13.5 million. That's a tremendous difference, mm-hmm. especially for somebody who we thought was going to be the front runner.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Darren.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Ashley. Ashley is calling from Charleston, North Carolina. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I go to a College of Charleston, which is in South Carolina, and Obama came to my school. It was actually the day that John Kerry had endorsed him, and he spoke at our school. And our school actually has a thing called a bully pulpit, which, you know, invites the candidates to come and talk with the community leaders, like business leaders, students, and answer their questions if they have any. But when he came here, what happened was he kind of took over in his campaign, didn't allow anybody to bring in any handwritten signs, and they in fact made their own handwritten signs to hand to people, but he also, it was just a speech. There was no answering of questions or anything like that. And his speech was very powerful. He reminded me a lot of maybe a preacher or something like that, but he didn't allow for anybody to ask him questions, and I think that I see that happening a lot in his campaign, where, you know, he gets up, he makes a speech, but then nobody is allowed to have any kind of discourse with him or have him answer any questions of any doubt they might have in the things that he's saying. And
All right, thanks, Ashley. I just want to get Ken to respond to that,
okay.
And thanks so much for your call. And also, Ken, adding my own question to her comments, which is Obama going to have to – this is not the first time I've heard that criticism, and is he going to have to start responding by doing a little bit more give and take with voters than he's been doing, or has he?
I'm not sure. I mean, obviously he's doing nothing wrong if he keeps winning everywhere, and of course that was the charge, that the thing that Ashley mentioned had been raised earlier about Hillary Clinton, that she either had staged events or staged questions or questions that were planted. Now that's since been changed, and I think Hillary Clinton has certainly been more open back and forth with voters. But you know, I always think of what happened on the night of last Tuesday. When Barack Obama had won Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and he was in this rally in Wisconsin, there were 17,000 people at this rally. And it just didn't seem like anything was wrong. He seemed like he had everything going his way. And I mean, I haven't heard people complaining that there's not been interaction, although I do not remember the last time he had a press conference. That's true. But he just seems to be on this roll that when you have 17,000 people screaming and chanting his name and, you know, we want change, as empty as that may seem to some people, it's still pretty effective.
All right, let's get one more call before the break. David is calling from New Jersey. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As to the trivia question, my guess, and I say it's only a guess, is Daniel Inouye. He's a senator from Hawaii.
Daniel Inouye is a senator from Hawaii, first elected in 1962 to the Senate, but no, he never ran for president.
Okay, and my question is, do you think that Barack Obama, since he's black, he's very young, 45 years old, just barely passes the age qualification for president, and since he has a total of about 2 years' experience in federal government, do you think he has a good chance of beating John McCain, who has so much experience? He's as American as apple pie, and he's even a war veteran.
It's a great question. I mean, as far as the war veteran part, we asked that in 1996 when Bill Clinton was running against Bob Dole, who was a war hero when George H.W. Bush was had war combat hero in 1992, combat experience, but that didn't seem to matter. As far as the experience angle, Hillary Clinton has been raising it over and over again, that she says she has 35 years of experience, obviously between her term and a half in the Senate and as First Lady, and that didn't seem to work either. But you make a very good point. In the general election, all bets are off. It could be a different ballgame completely if Barack Obama does run against John McCain.
All right, David, thanks for your call. And just very quickly, Ken, before the break, why is Huckabee staying in the race now? Let's turn to the Republicans for a moment. Why is he staying in the race? It's clear that McCain's going to get the nomination.
Well, that's true. And I'm almost disappointed that everybody keeps, not you, Lynn, but everybody seems to be asking Mike Huckabee, why aren't you dropping out? Or why should he drop out? He's not going to win the nomination, that's true. But he has something to say. He 37% of the voters yesterday in Wisconsin supported him. And actually, in some ways, this is actually good news for John McCain, because if there was no contest for the Republican nomination, if all we talked about were the Democrats, then John McCain wouldn't be on this program every week. We wouldn't be on CNN and the networks all the time. But also, their conservatives are not completely happy with John McCain. He still has to address their concerns.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. We're going to discuss political rhetoric when we come back from a short break. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. It's our weekly visit with the political junkie, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. And we want to turn now to the longstanding American tradition of lofty political rhetoric. John Kennedy had the gift, so did Ronald Reagan. Many say Barack Obama has that same ability to inspire those who hear him. But last night, both John McCain and Hillary Clinton took jabs at Obama's speaking style.
I will fight every moment of every day in this campaign to make sure Americans are not deceived by an eloquent but empty call for change.
I want to talk to you about the choice you have in this election and why that choice matters. It is about picking a president who relies not just on words, but on work, on hard work to get America back to work. That's our goal.
That was Senators Clinton and McCain talking about verbal swipes at Barack Obama's verbal ability. When it comes to eloquent oratory, how important is it that when deciding who to vote for? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Send us an email to talk@npr.org. And Ken, when your opponents start criticizing your ability with words, does that show how worried they really are about their situation? Or?
Well, there's certainly a frustration there because, I mean, both Hillary Clinton and John McCain are workhorses. I mean, they've spent a long time, you know, working on problems, dealing it. They're amazed that this guy who's had 2 years in the Senate is suddenly just knocking them dead. I mean, just, you know, getting tens of thousands of people showing up as if this were a rock concert. And I think it's just very frustrating to him. But people are also nervous because Jimmy Carter had a way of having platitudes, especially coming after Watergate. And a lot of people said, wait a second. I mean, he may be saying the right things, but what's going to happen? And ultimately, I would make the argument that his term in office was not a success, and they fear that Obama may do the same likewise.
So it's a fair criticism. I mean, it's fair for them to take him on that score.
Well, except at the time, if you make the case that the last 7 years have not been good for this country, if you make the case that the war has been unpopular, that President Bush is unpopular, there's nothing wrong with feeling good and feeling that there's a chance for a better future, and certainly nobody brings that better than Barack Obama.
Okay, we're going to bring in a new guest in a moment to join in this discussion, but before we do, I want to go over some trivia answers. Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, Barack Obama, of course, born in Hawaii. He won the Hawaii caucuses last time. Who was the last person to run for president who was born in Hawaii?
Okay, here's Chad's answer. Bob Dole, who owns Dole Pineapple, whose family owns Dole Pineapple?
Bob Dole was actually, he was born very close to Hawaii, Russell, Kansas, which is not far. If you have a very tiny map, it's very not far from Hawaii. No.
Robert Wilcox? And who is that?
I don't know.
We don't even know. Okay. S.I. Hayakawa.
S.I. Hayakawa, Sam Hayakawa, was elected to the Senate from California in 1976, but never ran for president. I think he may have been president of California State University, but didn't run for the United States president.
All right. So nobody's got it so far. Senator Hiram Fong.
Well, that's a good answer, too. Hiram Fong was a Republican favorite son candidate for president in 1968, but there was somebody born in Hawaii who ran for president since then.
Okay, so nobody's won that trivia contest yet. Let's bring another voice into our discussion about rhetoric now. David Frank is a professor of rhetoric in the Honors College at the University of Oregon, and he joins us from the studios of Don Ross Productions in Eugene, Oregon. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Professor Frank, what makes a great orator, first of all?
One who's able to develop a vision for an audience, to speak to the dreams the audience might have, to create a narrative and a myth that an audience might want to achieve. And Hillary Clinton back in January quoted Mario Cuomo saying, "You campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose." Hmm. So the ideal president would be one that would be able to campaign in poetry and govern in prose. They ought to be abilities that coexist. And certainly to govern, you need to be able to make use of prose rhetoric. But to govern, you also have to campaign. And if you're going to campaign, you have to be able to make use of poetic language and to set forth a vision for an audience that it might want to gain.
So great speakers do not necessarily translate into great leaders, but they can.
They can, and I'm hopeful they will. My colleague Mark McPhail has written widely on the notion of coherence, that is, that a person's speech should match the person's actions. And so Clinton and McCain, I think, are justly criticizing Obama for presenting eloquent speeches, but they want some action. And I think that's a fair criticism. At the same time, if one is going to be a successful president, one will need to be able to command poetry and command eloquence and command the ability to move people to action. And so the best presidents are those that can engage in poetic discourse, talk about dreams and visions and use alliterations, and also govern through prose.
All right, we'd like to hear, we're talking about Senator Barack Obama's speaking ability, that's all he has going for him is the fact that he can give a good speech, or whether he can, in fact, govern with prose, as you said. So let's hear a sample of that. This is Senator Barack Obama speaking to his supporters the night he won the Democratic primary in South Carolina.
The same message we had when we were up and when we were down. That out of many, we are one. That while we breathe, we will hope. And where we are met with cynicism and doubt and fear and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of the American people in three simple words: yes, we can. Thank you, South Carolina. I love you.
That was Senator Barack Obama. That was his victory speech the night that he won a hard-fought primary in South Carolina. And I think what you hear a clear example of there is Senator Obama's ability to inspire. And what I'd like to talk about a little bit with both of you is, what is the relationship between inspiration and leadership? How important is it for a leader to be able to inspire?
One should have a plan and a vision that is grounded in reality and good research, but one needs to translate that research and that plan into a poetic vision, a rhetorical vision that can attract the attention of an audience. In that clip that you played, Barack Obama eloquently pulled together the major themes of his address. Now, he needs, if he's elected president, to move from a campaign mode of poetry and vision and dreams and narrative to that of prose. And that is where Hillary Clinton excels. She's able to offer a plan. That's the major theme of her speeches. I have a plan, I have a plan. And certainly plans are necessary, but one reason that Obama is trumping Clinton in the public sphere is that he has such a strong control and command of language and metaphor and alliteration. And so my hope is that we will use the notion that Mark MacPhail offers of coherence, that we want a candidate and a president that can yoke poetry to prose and governance to an eloquent vision.
Ken Rudin, do you think both Senators Clinton and McCain, that they have found Barack Obama's weak spot by playing on this, by saying all he is you know, pretty words, poetry, he has no plan, there's nothing beyond the good speech?
Nothing behind the curtain with the Wizard of Oz,
right?
No, well, I don't think so. I don't think it's a weak spot at all because, again, I remember sitting and listening to Barack Obama the night of the South Carolina primary, and it was just a very, very moving speech. Compare that to Hillary Clinton winning New Hampshire. Now, that should have been a crowning moment for her, considering that every smarty-pants person in the country was writing her off, thinking that she had no chance to win, and she had a chance to lift up her candidacy and lift up her supporters. And I thought it was a very drab, almost, you know, just like a workmanlike speech with no rhetorical flourishes at all. So it, obviously, you know, look, I hate to use a pun, but there are pros and cons here. And I think the fact is that, you have to have something to say. But, of course, a lot has to do with the way you say it.
I know you hate using puns.
No, I hate
that. I know you do. And it took me a few seconds to get that one. All right. Let's go to Colby in Chicago. Hi, Colby. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm 35 years old. I'm in Chicago. One of the great intangibles about Obama right now for me is that in his speaking, he's reminding us that we as voters and we as citizens are agents of change in our own government. Whether you're a conservative my age who sees through 8 years of Clinton or a liberal who sees through 8 years of Bush, the sense of powerlessness in my generation has been palpable. And what he's doing in the way he talks and what I think he's starting to do even better now than he was earlier is reminding us that we are going to help him define his presidency, that it's our actions as citizens and that we are going to—I heard on NPR a couple days ago somebody said that we're going to put the meat and bones on his presidency. And that's something he's doing incredibly well. I think it speaks a lot to his own surge, and it's why I'm excited about him.
Colby, are you a younger generation? How old are you, Colby?
I'm 35.
You're 35, so you're not in that 20-something, but you're getting excited maybe for the first time in a while about politics, it sounds like.
In a long while, and, you know, that leads to my second question, and then I'll take it off the air. But, you know, this idea of baby boomer fatigue has been something that's really interested me. I mean, I know McCain is out of that. I guess he's a little bit out of that age range. But I also wonder, you know, the political rhetoric of a young man like Obama talking to young people. I definitely respond to that. I mean, even being 35, I'm not in my 20s, but I definitely respond to that as somebody who still, you know, considers myself not a boomer and still feels young and am very inspired by what he does. And then it reminds me that I have power to change the government that we have.
So. All right, great. Thanks so much for calling in, Colby.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Howard. He's in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hi, Howard. Are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I wanted to say that it's very easy to talk about rhetoric and charisma. No one in our lifetime had more rhetoric or charisma, but rhetorical ability or charisma than Adolf Hitler. And he was able to get out huge crowds to hear him and cheer him. And he turned out to be a terrible leader. I'm not suggesting that Barack Obama is Adolf Hitler, God forbid, but nevertheless, these are the dangers of empty rhetoric without a real program.
Thanks so much.
That's what I hear with Barack Obama.
All right. Professor Frank, I wonder if you can respond to that.
That's the ancient charge against the notion of rhetoric, that one can misuse rhetoric to lead people to do great evil. And that is why the rhetoricians invented liberal arts education to provide people with the ability to think through issues and then to solve problems with language and discourse and argumentation. And we are hopeful that if we are able to create an educated citizenry and students, that they will resist the temptations offered by people who are eloquent but are presenting evil or misguided policies. And so the aspiration would be to have both eloquence and wisdom. The aspiration would be to have someone who can speak to a vision, but is a vision that is well-grounded. For example, Barack Obama has offered a plan to deal with our crumbling infrastructure. You may not like it, but it is a plan that has specific details. But discussing those specific details in a campaign, I think, misses the point. You deal with the details when you go to the legislature. If you're not effective in persuading the senators and congressmen and women to vote for your plan, then your vision for infrastructure, in this case, might crumble. So one needs both the eloquence and the wisdom, the well-grounded argument that is phrased in a way that will appeal to a broad audience.
Okay, thanks, Professor David Frank. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ken Rudin, you want to comment
on
this one?
Expanding on what Professor Frank just said, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. If you think of John F. Kennedy, you think of his great eloquence during his inauguration, during the debates, during his campaign speeches. And yet once he got into office, January 1961, he was stymied by a Congress that obviously was no great hurry to let him have what he wanted or even know what he wanted. So the fear, of course, is for all of Barack Obama's eloquence, and I don't want to put him in the White House just yet, but we have to deal with the reality that Congress is very split down the middle. It could very well be split down the middle after the 2008 election, and all the things he would love to accomplish does not get accomplished.
All right, let's take another call. We're going to go to Jacob in San Jose, California. Jacob, go ahead.
Mr. Rudin, with the comment by Michelle Obama regarding her absence, pride, don't you think that's a dark horse issue, namely loyalty at this time in the national experience? The author Carl Bernstein wrote a book on loyalty. It was about him and his family and President Harry Truman's loyalty boards, if you remember those. And don't you think that with Mike Huckabee, presidential candidate, in his campaign platform, he has a plank regarding getting rid of dual citizenship.
Okay. Jacob, I think you're folding a little bit too much into this question. I think you began talking about a comment that Michelle Obama might have made regarding her patriotism. Do you know what I'm referring to, Ken?
Well, I'd like him to expand on the question a little bit more. I do know that there is a famous Michelle Obama quote saying that I've never been proud of my country until now, and a lot of people have taken that as a pretty upsetting, you know, if that's what we're talking about. But I'm not sure what the question is.
Yeah, I think he was trying to say perhaps that might be a problem for Obama. No comment. Okay, we're going to try and take one more call now. We're going to go to Bob in Sacramento, California. Bob, you on the air? Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to take a shot at the trivia question. Was it Congresswoman Patsy Meek who ran for president?
That is the correct answer. 1972, she ran. She decided that her make or break state was the state of Oregon, and she got like 6,000 votes. She was the first woman of color ever elected to Congress. Patsy Meek is the correct answer.
Good for you, Bob, and that's what you get as a prize.
2 weeks in Philadelphia.
Good show. Yeah, my brother went to the University of Hawaii, and she was one of his professors.
Great. Thank you very much for calling in, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, and thanks so much to Professor David Frank for joining us today. Appreciate it, Professor Frank.
Thank you.
Professor Frank is a professor of rhetoric at the Honors College at the University of Oregon. And Ken, just to wrap this up a little bit, this whole question of Obama's rhetoric, is it empty? Does he really have any plan? Is there any there? Do you see him in any way changing what he's doing as we proceed?
Well, there's really no need to. And I really think the charge of empty rhetoric is a little bit is a campaign charge, because I mean, he says a lot of things, a lot of lofty things. The themes are very important if a lot of people have been disillusioned over the years. But he is still talking about his plans for health care reform, about, you know, prescription drug plans, about how to get out of Iraq, his differences with John McCain, the Bush administration, which will no longer, will no doubt.
So is it a bad idea for his opponents to use that tactic in trying to?
No, because they're frustrated because, again, a lot of times he'll just say the word like change and 100,000 people will say, oh, my God, this is amazing. And Hillary Clinton say, wait a second. What's going on here?
All right. Thanks for being with us, Ken.
Thanks, Lynn.
NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin. Coming up, look up. The skies are getting crowded. A lunar eclipse, a shuttle landing, and an unruly spy satellite. We'll give you a full report next. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.